Welcome back to Peacecast. I'm Ori Neer, and with me is Peacecast's co-producer, APN's Max Albert Deitch. Hi, Max.
Hi, Ori. How are you today?
I am fine, thanks. Busy day. Today is November 21st, 2023. It's the 46th day of the Gaza war, and we're at last hearing some good news today. An impending ceasefire to allow the release of some hostages who are held in Gaza. There's going to be a better flow of humanitarian support for Gazan civilians and the release of all Palestinian minors who are held in Israeli prisons, which is all good news. The deal, as we speak, is being discussed by the Israeli cabinet, and we really hope that it'll be ratified. But the crisis for civilians in Gaza and the Gaza Strip is still dire. If you watch the footage coming from, Gaza, from mainly the northern part of the Gaza Strip, you realize that the largest Palestinian city, Gaza City, is all but destroyed. Almost all residents of Gaza City and adjacent communities, there are many refugee camps there, have almost all been displaced, moving to the southern part of the Strip. If you watch these videos, you are probably aware of the dire humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip writ large. Refugees who have been re-displaced and are reliving the traumas of their past. Gaza's never been an easy place to live in. I remember how shocked I was when I first visited Gaza in the mid-1980s. It has now turned into I don't want to say living hell, but a much, much more difficult place to live in. The challenge of managing the humanitarian crisis in the short run currently is very serious. The challenge, however, of rebuilding Gaza is really monumental. And this is the main issue that we wanted to discuss today. We invited two experts in this field, both headed the West Bank and Gaza Strip office of the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. They are Larry Garber and Dave Harden. Dave headed the office between 2013 and 2016, and Larry between 1999 and 2004. They are two of seven former mission directors of the USAID program in the West Bank and Gaza between the years 1994 and 2019, who sent a letter to Secretary of State Antony Blinken with some observations and proposed principles regarding how to approach the challenge of post-war Gaza, what post-war Gaza is going to look like. So, Dave and Larry, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Same here.
We often ask our guests to introduce themselves and to give our listeners just a few words, a little bit of grounding in what you do and how you got here. So could the two of you please just tell us and our listeners a little bit about yourselves?
So I've worked since the early 1980s, mostly internationally, on issues pertaining to human rights, elections and democracy, and international development. I served at USAID as a political appointee during both the Clinton and Obama administrations, including, as Ori mentioned, 5 years as the mission director of the West Bank Gaza program. And noteworthy, this was immediately before and during most of the second intifada. Immediately after my tenure as mission director, I headed the New Israel Fund from 2004 to 2009. And lastly, I'll mention my role as an election observer of the Palestinian presidential elections in 2005, the legislative elections in 2006, and most recently, the municipal elections in the West Bank in March 2022. And as part of that last mission, I had the opportunity to visit Gaza for a day and a half in late March, so about 18 months ago, and was able, just to observe what was happening at that time in Gaza. Dave, over to you.
Okay, thanks, Larry. And thanks all for having us on. It's an exciting podcast, so we're really grateful. I grew up in a small town in rural America on a small farm and had nothing to do with the Middle East. I ended up going into the Peace Corps, into Africa right after college, and then I became a corporate lawyer and I worked in New York. I eventually joined the Foreign Service and I served as a lawyer for USAID in South Asia and then in Central Asia. And then in 2005, I was assigned to the West Bank and Gaza as the deputy mission director. And I came right before Gaza disengagement. And of course, at that time, there was also some forced settlements in the north of the West Bank that were also evacuated. And I served effectively continuously from 2005 to 2016 in a variety of roles. So I was the deputy mission director for 4 years. And then I was the senior economics advisor to George Mitchell when he was the special envoy for Middle East peace for Barack Obama. I took some excursions to Libya and Baghdad. I kept my family in Tel Aviv. And then I came back as the mission director from 2013 through 2016 and worked closely with the Kerry team as they were trying to work out some negotiations. After I left government, and by the way, after my assignment in West Bank and Gaza, I eventually made my way to Riyadh, where I oversaw the Saudi-Yemen war. And the U.S. aid response to that. After I left government, I actually ran a tech firm in Ramallah that had Israeli and Palestinian investors. And so that was a really great opportunity. We didn't make it after COVID or during COVID, we kind of collapsed. But I've been involved, really since 2005 on the Israeli-Palestinian account. I did go to Gaza in 2019. I didn't go as a diplomat or a reporter or an aid worker or UN official. I went as a business guy that was simply looking to hire software engineers. And so with that, I'll turn it back to you all.
Thank you. Wow, you guys are both incredibly accomplished. We're really, really glad to have you guys on here. So your letter to Secretary Blinken ends with the words, "We wish you courage and perseverance as you lead America through the biggest challenge in the Middle East in many decades." The challenge, as you put it, is multifaceted. What we'd really like to discuss with you today is two aspects of it. The first is how to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, chiefly the civilian population that's been displaced, as Ori mentioned earlier. And the other is how to rebuild Gaza. So let's start with managing the immediate crisis, mostly in the southern Gaza Strip, where, I mean, almost all of the population from the northern part of the Strip has escaped to. How do you approach that, realizing that we're not only talking about short-term solutions to this immediate challenge, but we're talking about solutions that have to be sustainable. They have to last years. I mean, the rebuilding process isn't going to be a super quick, immediate thing. And it sounds so basic, but where does one begin to tackle a crisis or circumstance like what we're seeing?
Dave, why don't you start? One of the things you missed in your biography is the fact that you headed up for a year and a half the Bureau of Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance, where these were the type of issues that you grappled with daily. So, you know, you're probably in a better position just to lead off, and I'll follow on the humanitarian assistance.
Thanks. I did skip over that that response for all global crises around the world. Look, it's a very, very difficult situation, and none of us should be naive about any simple solutions. Let me tell you what worries me a little bit more. So right now, northern Gaza is essentially divided along Wadi Gaza, and anything north of that is essentially vacated. And all of the population has now moved south of Wadi Gaza. We are now, you know, preparing for and seeing the potential of attacks further south in the Khan Yunis and the areas around there, which effectively divides the Gaza Strip again in half. So about 75% of the Gaza Strip then would be under, you know, active military combat and control by the Israelis, with most of the population then in a quarter of the Gaza Strip. The pressure on that is so immense that I actually worry that there could be a breach of the Rafah border, not simply the crossing, but the entire Egyptian border with Gaza. And you see, you know, perhaps some bit of fanciful thinking about setting up some refugee camps in the old settlements areas near Khan Yunis, Gush Katif. And having kind of some sea access and putting in some hospitals, field hospitals, and maybe even, you know, ship hospitals and all that. There's a lot that's not realistic in a highly kinetic environment. So I really worry about the practicality of that. In the short term, you know, a 4 or 5 day pause for the hostage exchange, assuming it actually happens, would help alleviate the most dire situation. But you're going to have to, you're going to have an increasingly aggrieved and population that is suffering immensely as the campaign moves south. So I don't think there are real easy answers here. Larry, you must have some ideas as well.
So the thing that I think about in this context is the distinction between natural disasters and post-conflict situations. In both cases, you look to address the immediate needs, which we characterize water, food, health. In case of Gaza, obviously, shelter is going to be critical. You try to, you know, work on some basic, job creation to stimulate, revive an economy. But the difference between the natural disaster context and the post-conflict, and I would put, you know, what's going on in Gaza more in that latter category, is that the political considerations inevitably come into play. I mean, you're dealing with not only a kinetic situation, but a highly politicized situation. So, you know, in Gaza, you're going to have to deal with the question of, where are the people going to stay initially? Are they going to be allowed to go back to northern Gaza, assuming, you know, the kinetic operation is over? You're going to have to deal with, even in terms of, moving in certain types of assistance, as we've seen, with the Israeli security concerns. I mean, it's not just that, you know, you line up at the border and you transfer goods into the area, which would be the case in a natural disaster. But here you're going to have to go through this whole political situation of, you know, is Israel confident that, you know, the things that they don't want smuggled in are being smuggled in? You'll have to deal with the issue of who handles the distribution. You know, the UN has a highly, highly sophisticated and well-organized system in Gaza, not only through UNRWA, but through many of the specialized agencies. And again, you know, at least in the last month, Israel has, you know, criticized heavily the Secretary General, but also people on the ground who work for the UN. And so, you know, the question is, will the UN be able to effectively serve in that role of providing, you know, the most essential assistance? And finally, you have the question of, you know, who's going to pay for it? You know, even the short-term humanitarian assistance, you know, in a politicized situation, it becomes a question of who the funders are going to be and whether they're going to be able to do it with, you know, their priorities as opposed to someone else's self-imposed priorities. So I just think that we just need to recognize that difference between the normal natural disaster response with humanitarian assistance and the very particular responses that are needed in a post-conflict environment.
You know, if I can just jump in, Larry makes some excellent points, and there's been a lot of commentary about the analogy to either Fallujah or Mosul. And I want to make a distinction with those. In the case of both Fallujah and Mosul, there were local military forces on the ground that were aligned with U.S. operations. And so that made the operations a lot more effective and in many ways, perhaps quicker. But in addition, the people had somewhere to go. Right. So they weren't bound to a specific geographic space. We don't have either of those in this instance. And that's a pretty big distinction from what we are scene. The other point that I would just make, and because I ran many USAID responses to the conflicts in Gaza over the years, it's actually fuel that's the most important thing, because without fuel, you can't pump the water and you can't run the sewage systems. And that really kind of affects health and human well-being really, really rapidly. So with that, I'll turn it back to you all.
Okay, so I'd like to ask you to maybe just break down a little bit some of those challenges that you mentioned. Let's go beyond the first, you know, few days, the first even month or so, assuming that it'll take time for people to actually return to the northern Gaza Strip because there's really nothing to return to at the moment. How do you go about building a temporary infrastructure in the southern Gaza Strip for this population that's going to be there temporarily? I mean, you need to provide people a place to live. So what is it going to be, a tent city, water supply, sanitation, and so on and so hospitals, schools? First of all, who would be best equipped to do it? Is it UNRWA? Or a different UN agency? And secondly, how do you do all that? The nuts and bolts, I think, are really interesting here. So if you can talk a little about that would be great.
I'll start on this one. So I think on the WHO side, I mean, UNRWA, I mean, again, this is why the political issues become so sensitive. I mean, UNRWA is clearly, you know, targeted at the, you know, refugee population and was servicing a significant amount of the Gaza population. But I think there's going to be, a question of whether UNRWA should or wants to take over responsibility for more than, you know, the population that they already had. There are a number of, you know, non-governmental organizations that have worked in Gaza for long periods of time, international NGOs, you know, that are mobilized and probably either have or can quickly, you know, obtain the necessary materials that they need for, you know, dealing with, you know, whether it's tents or food supplies or even water, bringing that in. But again, I think Dave's point is, you know, where are they going to be able to put all these people? Oh, you know, not for, you know, a few days, but for months in southern Gaza. And again, a lot of these people, again, this is the political side, a lot of these people are going to clearly want to return as quickly as they can to their homes, you know, in northern Gaza, even if they've been destroyed, just to reassert their property rights and that the fact that they're not leaving. So I think all those things complicate the normal, you know, I mean, my impression, Dave probably can correct me on this, but I think the United States and the international community has a fairly good sense of how to respond to these humanitarian assistance crises. We've had to do it, you know, in a number of, difficult situations, and we know the basic pieces of it. There are usually good coordination mechanisms set up to deal with the immediate needs. But here it's, you know, how do you deal with it in this broader political context? But Dave, you've had much more experience with me on the nuts and bolts side. So maybe you can, you know, describe some of that.
So let me make a few observations. First is the security envelope and the Israeli role in that. Secondly is the nature of displacement and how long it lasts. And third is the role of the private sector. So in terms of the security envelope, it may very well be the case that the Israelis will demand security oversight of anything that goes into Gaza in terms of rebuilding. And that's not an unreasonable position given the experience with Hamas and the tunnels and their ability to bring in an enormous stockpile of weapons. However, a full security envelope around Gaza is effectively no different than where we were on October 6th. And that's going to be a real problem for the entire world, for the Palestinians, for any Arab donors, and maybe any other donors. And so I think we're going to have to work through some mechanisms that would give the Israelis confidence about the security envelope around Gaza, where they don't have a direct kind of oversight and heavy, slow engagement with the reconstruction, which goes to the second point, and that is displacement and reconstruction takes forever. There's probably displacement still from 2021 and 2014. And if you even look at the numbers of people who returned back to Mosul all these years later, there's still a lot of people that have never returned. And so I don't think people are going to go back to destroyed homes in northern Gaza, where there's going to be an enormous amount of unexploded ordnances and kind of inability to restart life in all that rubble. And so you're looking at years and years and years, I think, of displacement. And then thirdly, there's not enough money in the international community to rebuild Gaza. I'm going to give you a quick analogy to Yemen and the humanitarian crisis there. You know, the international community put a lot of food aid and immediate assistance, humanitarian assistance into Yemen. But the reality is only about 5% of all the aid, which was targeted towards the most vulnerable, constituted the amount of food stocks that were required for that marketplace. The private sector has to work. The shops have to work. The shops are going to have to, have electricity and water and sanitation and the bakeries and the restaurants and the construction teams and all that will have to work. And you will get more rapid both humanitarian stability and reconstruction to the extent that the private sector is engaged. But all of this then bumps up against the first two points, right? The security envelope and what it is that the Israelis are going to need that will instill confidence, but still allow things to progress, and the kind of fundamental nature of displacement.
Can I just add one point going particularly to security and how we come up with an appropriate mechanism? One of the challenges is that we've been here before. I mean, so we have tried, and Dave's been involved in a lot of these negotiations over mechanisms to ensure, that goods can move back and forth. And, on both sides, I think that there are going to be questions. Certainly, the implementers of assistance, whether humanitarian or others in the past, have complained about the restrictions being too strict and, causing all kinds of problems, delays in planning and implementing and the like. And on the other hand, the Israelis are just simply going to say, look, we had these things in place and look how much, was smuggled in one way or another. And therefore, we're going to need an even tighter regime. So, there's something to build from, but neither side is happy with the way that worked. And so how, a new regime is negotiated that can address now a much more serious, magnitude of several fold serious humanitarian crisis is going to be a real challenge, very much along the lines that Dave was talking about.
Yeah. So while we're talking about responsibility and the work that private organizations are doing and stepping up, since October 7th, there's been so much conversation about humanitarian corridors and whose job it is to open those up. And in the meantime, the US is sending aid. Egypt is helping airlift premature babies out of hospitals in Gaza. So here's my question. Who is legally responsible for, not just morally obligated to deal with, the refugees, the damage, the future rebuilding efforts, especially looking at the way that Israel has effectively reoccupied large chunks of Gaza?
So I'm going to use Shifa as an example. And let's assume for argument's sake, which I think is will probably be borne out, is that, one step back. Shifa is a large complex. It's 22 acres and multiple, buildings that are multiple stories, right? And And let's assume that Hamas used the Shifa compound or parts of the Shifa compound for combatant activities against Israel. So it loses its protected status. But here's what isn't lost. The patients and the medical staff never lose their protected status. They retain that protected status going forward. And to coin a phrase from Colin Powell, once you break it, you own it. So the Israelis own Shifa Hospital, and they have an ongoing duty of care to the patients and to provide for the medical staff to continue to operate there. That's just the bottom line, right? And you can then kind of take that working theory, that working assumption, and just push this forward about the role of the occupier and their responsibilities and duty of care to civilian populations, which is an enormous undertaking for the Israelis. At the same time, you know, who else is going to do it, right? Is the UN going to do it after all of this? Both some legitimate criticism against the UN, but also some illegitimate criticism against the UN. I mean, I think we've seen pretty clearly that the Arab states aren't going to be occupiers, in a sense, of Gaza. And so it's very unclear to me who will retain. And of course, Netanyahu doesn't want the Palestinian Authority to come in. So it's very unclear to me about who will retain actual effective control. And in the absence, it's going to be the Israelis as the occupying force. Larry?
Yeah, I agree. But I think there's, you know, what we should look at is sort of like a time phase. So before Israel tried to deny responsibility as an occupying force before October 7th, and basically put the onus on others, whether it was the UN agencies, international agencies, you know, the PA, you know, sort of without really being in control, and even Hamas. I mean, you know, the whole transfer of funds from the, you know, Qatar to, you know, the de facto authority was in a recognition that someone had to be providing this. Clearly, you know, now that Israel's de facto and de jure occupying Gaza, then the you know, burden shifts, and they're responsible for these things. I mean, they can make arrangements with other people to, you know, be the actual implementers, but they are legally responsible. But the question is, I think, you know, and Dave alluded to this, and I think we've read this, you know, they don't want to be the occupying, you know, to assume those type of responsibilities. So, you know, a big challenge politically for Israel, you know, even before we get to, you know, post-conflict, is how do they ensure that the basic human needs of the population in Gaza are being met without having to say we are the ones who are legally responsible for doing it. And so I think that's going to be, you know, something that is going to have to be worked out over the next, you know, a few weeks, clearly, because they're going to be there at least for the next month or two, for sure. So, you know, how do they, you know, take on that responsibility yet not have to be the day-to-day implementers of the responding to the humanitarian needs?
There was a story yesterday in the Israeli media that the Israeli government is going to propose that Tony Blair will be a kind of a czar overlooking the whole operation. Never mind for a moment Blair. I'm bringing it up because it suggests to us that the Israeli government is looking for some kind of an international mechanism. But my question to you is from a practical perspective, is it more effective to have one person who is kind of a quarterback for the entire operation?
So I want to walk through some realities here, and Larry and I may be on the same page here, or we may not. I'm not entirely sure. So I don't see an easy off-ramp, right? I mean, it's clear that the Israelis have degraded the infrastructure in the northern part of Gaza, and it may be likely 50 hostages are released. But in terms of their overall war aims, they you know, Hamas still exists. The senior leadership still exists. If 50 hostages come out, then 190 hostages are still in control. And there's not any real calm, both in Gaza and in the Northern Front. And so I think that you're likely to see kinetic action, even if there's full occupation down to Khan Yunis or all the way down to Rafah. I think you should expect ongoing kinetic activity in a bit of a hot war, kind of indefinitely. So it's going to be hard to do reconstruction. And let's just be clear, reconstruction means rebar and cement coming in. Okay. You can't do reconstruction without and heavy equipment. You can't do reconstruction without any of that. And so,
and I'll just explain to our listeners the reason why you are underscoring that is that in the past Israel has objected to it because it's dual use.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and listen, anything can be dual use at a certain point, right? So you gotta, you know, there's a balance that you have to undertake. And I mean, I just want to reiterate that the tunnels were deep and sophisticated and almost an engineering feat. And over since 2005, for all intents and purposes, Hamas has been able to effectively rearm, both in terms of manufacturing and importing, you know, pretty lethal capabilities. And so in a post-hot conflict, Is Israel going to be comfortable allowing the basic building blocks for reconstruction to come in? You know, it's really unclear to me. And I think that needs to be settled, and kind of the operating environment of, let's say, a Gaza reconstruction czar or a multinational force, and what their level of responsibility and engagement will be, because there will be problems.
But I want to, you know, react already to the sort of narrower question. I mean, even before we get to the reconstruction side, in theory, yes, it would be better to have, you know, a single point of contact who can then coordinate the various different agencies, whether UN or others, that are going to be involved in the even the delivery of humanitarian assistance. And we often see this in post-natural disasters and conflict situations, that you do have some type of, you know, lead agency or lead person. And certainly someone, you know, who has the prominence of Tony Blair, you would think would be, you know, the right person. But, you know, I'm just not sure that everyone is going to accept him, particularly if he's viewed as the Israeli designate. And so I think even that issue is going to be contested, because you know, Tony Blair can't operate. He's nothing. He needs to be, you know, supervising someone. And so unless you get, you know, the Egyptians and the, you know, the Gulf states that are going to fund some of this, and the various agencies to accept that, yes, this guy who the Israelis are designating is the right person for this, it's not going to work. And, you know, it'll be a real, you know, loss of time in a sense to be haggling over, you know, whether Tony Blair has authority over X or Y, as opposed to really getting the countries and organizations involved to say, okay, here's the right person. I mean, I don't think it can be just Israel's designation of him as the
person. I'm pretty sure the Palestinians would reject Tony Blair. They wouldn't meet with him towards the end of his leadership of the quartet. And I'm not sure the Arab world would accept Tony Blair either. But this is, look, let's assume for argument's sake that we can find a Gaza reconstruction czar. There are some opportunities with technology that might mitigate some of these risks. In 2005 and 2006, we set up which didn't work, but it was also early stage technology, remote sensing on the Rafah border to allow real-time assessment of passengers and their personal effects coming into Rafah. Now, it ultimately failed for a few reasons, including the fact that it was shelled by Hamas, I guess, and made inoperable. But you could envision some kind of remote sensing and tracking of material that is more sophisticated now than what it was in the past. And I will say that after 9/11, we had remote sensing capability at some of the major ports in areas that would be a little bit more problematic, like Karachi. And so we had real-time eyes on what was being loaded and unloaded. Now, the Israelis have a deeper standard on inspection regimes than the Americans do. And their argument to me was, well, you guys are just trying to stop drugs. We're just trying to stop, you know, weapons and terrorists from coming in. But I do think that the U.S. has something to share in terms of inspection regimes. And together, we should be able to get something with the new technology that would kind of facilitate this. But overall, the real problem is a political one, like Larry laid out, right? Who's going to fund it? Who's going to oversee it? What are their authorities going to be? What are their authorities going to be when there's when somebody steals a car, or when there's a shot at one of the UN or a multi-force observer people? Are they going to have policing authority? Because that puts foreign police and military in the middle of a conflict, which very few countries are going to want to do.
So let's talk about that larger challenge of rebuilding. And I want to bring us back to that point about rebar and construction. I want to bring it down to specific action steps, because I think a lot of our listeners hear the words rebuilding or reconstruction, and I honestly don't know what they're picturing. I think that it's a very vague thing to a lot of people here in the US. So I'm hoping that you can break it down into just some specific action steps and really give our listeners a sense of the infrastructure and the physical steps that are required to build back any sense of life for the city.
So let me, if I may, start with this one. So you're going to have an enormous amount of unexploded ordnances all over the place. That makes that space inoperable and uninhabitable until it's mapped and removed. And there are unexploded ordnances in the West Bank from 1967 and 1948 still, you know, that make agricultural production in certain areas impossible. So I don't want to minimize the overwhelming constraint of unexploded ordnances. Once you are able to clear the area of unexploded ordnances, then you're going to have a massive amount of rubble. And that rubble is going to require heavy equipment to move it out of the way. Most rapid reconstruction, particularly for houses or individual shops, will be at the household level. So it's probably faster and cheaper to let families do it. But that presents a risk, because suddenly you have like massive decentralized flows of rebar and tools and construction teams and cement coming in all over the place, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of networks that are beginning to do this kind of reconstruction. Of course, you have the financing behind all that, like who actually is going to pay for it. And all of these are very, very difficult in an era where the Israelis are reminded of October 7th.
I want to, Max, just back up a step in terms of the question, because one of the things, and I think Dave's right. I mean, we need to understand what the dangers are physically just going into these places, and what needs to be done in terms of the setting the table by removing the rubble and things like that. But part of this also is a planning process, and some of this, the question about planning is, can it begin? When can it begin, and what type of assumptions do you need to make? And I remember during the Second Intifada, we had a program, a very ambitious program, and we had to cut it way back. But we constantly would say, we would think about alternative scenarios, And it would be like, okay, status quo plus, where we can go back to doing what we originally intended, and status quo minus, where we would, you know, have to curtail it even more. Here we're working where then we had unknowns, but they were within a realm of sort of, you know, the issues that we understood. Here we're dealing with, you know, a lot of unknowns that we have no idea about: governance, security, the things that we were just talking about, the level of, so how do you do planning in that type of context? And it's very challenging. Also, we need to know, you know, I mean, we collectively, donors and others, invested a great deal in Gaza over the last 25 years. And there's, you know, there were things that were built that had made the life of quality of life of the people better. I mean, I was surprised when I went back in March 2022 to just see the road along the seashore with all these new hotels that had gone up in the last, you know, probably 10 years since I had been there before. So how, you know, what are you going to prioritize in terms of rebuilding, and what is left of what was built? You know, so are the desalination plants salvageable at all, or do you really have to start from zero? There were all kinds of water pipelines that were laid. Again, do you have to start from zero, or can you, quote unquote, rehabilitate them? The power plants. You know, these are basic infrastructure that you know, are essential even to begin some of the other reconstruction that's needed. In parallel to that, you're going to need to have, you know, some of the self-initiative, you know, supported by outside actors, but self-initiative at the household level to rebuild houses and things like that. But my sense at this point, and we don't have a good assessment of it, is that a lot of this core infrastructure that's essential for, you know, modern day life in a place like Gaza has been severely impaired, if not totally destroyed. And so the first thing we need to do is to understand just what is left in Gaza that can be used as part of, you know, an initial reconstruction plan before you think, you know, grandly about, you know, how do you build back better, or, you know, have improved infrastructure delivering basic services. And one other thing I would just add is just to, the reality in Gaza is you have huge number of, children under 18. And what are you going to do with them during this period? I mean, schools, we assume in the north, have been totally destroyed. You're going to need teachers. You're going to need, you know, to get these kids back into a system. And again, that to me, in this case, would be one of the priorities, both because I think Palestinians really care about education, but also because you want to give, you know, some alternatives to, you know, just people hanging out on the streets.
So, you know, the Biden administration has, it seems like it's been pretty ambitious about its goals in terms of post-war. And optimist that I am, I'm just kind of trying to think about, you know, we talked about kind of the difference between rebuilding and recreating. Do you think, knowing how past administrations worked, particularly facing these types of challenges, that there's going to be a real hunger with the administration in to really recreate Gaza, maybe to try to push for the building of a seaport, airport, better infrastructure, maybe rebuilding the refugee camps so that they're not refugee camps anymore? What do you think?
I'm smiling because I went to Gaza the first, to West Bank Gaza as a mission director in 1999, right after the Y River Accords had been approved and right after there was a huge supplemental for Palestinian assistance. And we had all these ambitious plans. So the airport, I remember visiting it in 1999 when I was there. It was operating, it was functioning. And, you know, it's hard to believe now, but it was shut down and basically destroyed at the outset of the Second Intifada. There were lots of plans, you know, I mean, I always joke that they're still probably lying on someone's table the designs that we had done, very elaborate designs for a seaport, for, you know, major water carriers and the like. You know, some of it was, you know, actually built in the last 17 years since I left, the post, but in not, I think, the same ambitious way that we had hoped for in 1999. So the plans are there, but you know, you're first going to have to deal with the issues that they've put out there of, you know, clearing the space, making sure, you know, it's safe for people to go to these places, you know, and then the natural wariness of outside funders to fund again something that, you know, they think they, funded 10 years ago, 20 years ago, that's now been destroyed. And what guarantees are they going to have that it won't be destroyed again? So you're going to have that psychological hurdle to overcome also in terms of, why are these good investments today as opposed to, before?
You know, Uri, you asked a really good question. Will there be a hunger in the U.S. for Gaza reconstruction? I think the short answer to that is no. We're facing an enormous amount of challenges domestically. We have an election coming up. You know, you don't get a lot of votes for foreign assistance writ large, and you're not going to get a lot of votes for Gaza foreign assistance. And I will say this. You know, during the beginning of the Obama administration, when George Mitchell came in, that, you know, aside from Larry's time, that was really kind of a peak of hope. And I used to think that if I would work a little bit harder, or if I was a little bit better of a negotiator, if I was a little more innovative, if I was a little smarter, we would, you know, we would get a two-state solution, peace in our time. And I remember our driver, who I still speak to today, told me, Dave, we're never going to have peace. You know, and I think that I agree that we need to do the planning and we need to think about a day after. I think that both Blinken and Biden have been overly optimistic about what Gaza looks like and their principles and the immediacy of those principles and what the reconstruction looks like. And I think the more likely outcome is that you're going to have grievances. You're going to have deep-seated grievances that could run for generations. The young boys and girls that Larry just referenced, whose houses have been destroyed, and now they're living, you know, in a hovel in Rafah, who are going to go back to Beit Hanina someday, or Gaza City someday, or Jabalia someday. You know, there's going to have to be some massive changes in what they see the world bringing to them, in order to get an off ramp that allows both Israelis and the Palestinians to live in the same shared geographic space between the Mediterranean and the sea, between the sea and the river. So we have a real long and complicated road ahead of us.
Ori, I remember when I, one of the conceptions that we had back in 99, 2000, in particular, when the Intifada was first starting, the second Intifada was first starting, was that there was no way the Palestinians were going to give up what they had accomplished in the last 5 years. You know, that the economy had, you know, been growing. You know, there were all kinds of, you know, economic benefits that we assumed people were seeing. And we just, I certainly myself, but I think this was true throughout the government, our government, was we just couldn't imagine that the Palestinians would sacrifice this by going back to conflict. And whether it was intended or, you know, just started happening, clearly it did dramatically affect the population. But what the lesson it taught me was that you can't ignore the politics. And no matter, you know, how much we can envision this, you know, Gaza as Singapore, as we used to say, you know, unless the political vision is there, it's just, you know, why would anyone invest, you know, if they're just afraid that someone is going to come and compromise it at some point. So I think, and that's why I think our letters properly stressed, you know, the importance of creating, you know, that vision at the outset and not waiting for, an economic, first solution. There has to be a clear sense of where we think this is going to go.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. I'm happy that you brought it up and brought it back to the letter and to the question of a vision for the future. I thought I'd end the conversation with a quick story. The first time I went to Gaza in 1986, it was, I remember going to Shati refugee camp, and there was a weekly kind of open market where they sold all sorts of trinkets. And for example, there was a guy who was selling toys. It wasn't real toys. It was toys that they brought from Israel, you know, a doll that was lacking, you know, a couple of limbs and things like that. It looked horrible. And I remember going to an old woman who was there, and in my still Shakespearean Arabic at the time, Fusha, I'm asking her, what are your thoughts about the future and about the politics? And I end the question by saying, so what it is that you would like? And she says one word, mu'an. Mu'an in Arabic means rations, the kind of rations that UNRWA was giving at the time, food. They were hungry for food. So yes, the plans for the future of Gaza are extremely important, but this will have to be baby steps, and we will have to start with the very, very basics, food and water and fuel in the short run. And let's all hope that it goes well, because really this is something that is not just a matter of, the humanitarian situation for Gazan refugees and non-refugees. This is something that Israel has a huge interest in, and others as well, the United States and other regional players. Yeah. Go ahead, Larry.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, leaving aside, all the security and other issues, I mean, as we've all seen over the last month, just the images, and we're seeing the images, mostly on Western media and the like, but the images that, I've been told from Palestinian friends that are on, various Arab stations are just 100 times, more gruesome than what we're seeing on a daily basis. And, that just creates the type of environment that's, going to be a real issue for Israel, in the short term and in the long term. So I think it is certainly in Israel's interest to ensure that the humanitarian considerations are addressed, but they need to be addressed with a sense that, Palestinians are also looking for a, some type of vision for, how we're going to get out of this mess eventually.
Dave, any final thoughts?
I mean, the tragedy of the current situation, beginning with October 7th, but running through today, just overwhelms. And there will be a time in which it ends. What we don't know is if this is, when the fighting stops, will it be 1945 or will it be 1919, right? And I think, what we want is for this to be 1945, and where combatants can lay down arms and build a common prosperous future. But it's just so hard to know if that's realistic or fanciful. So, we, Larry and I and all of us here have put decades of our lives on these issues, and it can be discouraging at times, but you have to remain an optimist. And you have to hope that the arc of justice and goodness bends in a positive direction.
Inshallah.
Yes, inshallah, Habibi, inshallah.
Dave, Larry, your voices are so welcome on this matter, and your expertise is so valuable. Thank you for joining us for this conversation. We're really, really glad that we had the chance to have y'all on.
Great. Thank you guys for doing this on a regular basis.
Yeah, thank you.
And happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.